Welcome to VBAC Bird Stories. Join us as we speak to Australian women about their journey towards a vaginal birth after cesarean.
In Australia, the cesarean rate has risen to 36%. That's one of the highest rates in the developed world. We hope that by sharing these stories, women and their care providers are able to gain insight into why these rates are on the increase. We also get to meet and understand the women behind these numbers.
We are your hosts, Mel and Steph, and we hope you enjoy Season 3 of VBAC Birth Stories.
VBAC Birth Stories acknowledge the ongoing connection that Aboriginal people have to this land and recognise Aboriginal people as the original custodians of the land on which we stand.
This podcast is produced on Darugan Gundagara and Gadigal land, and we would like to pay respect to its elders, past and present.
Hi everyone, we hope wherever you are this school holidays that you have been keeping dry, particularly if you're in New South Wales and you've been affected by the recent floods. Also, happy NAIDOC week from Mel and I. This week, we're really excited to introduce to you Amelia's story. Amelia is a 21-year-old Dijab Wurrung woman, and this week, Mel and I are sharing with you her two birth stories in honour of NAIDOC week. Millie actually only found out about the details of her Indigenous ancestry when she was 12 and who her family were related to. She grew up learning about her cultural practices, and a part of the disappointment in her first birth was actually about that disconnect between these practices and the public hospital system. Later on, she would learn that there was a program dedicated to Indigenous women that she would seek to be a part of. She's a mother of two, and she really seeks to give back by working with her community in Melton, Victoria. Amelia gives a refreshing take on birth and pregnancy. In her youth is this no-nonsense approach to what she wants out of her births, and she has a positivity to her which is really quite inspiring. She has wisdom to her which is really beyond her 21 years, and we hope that you find both of her stories help you wherever you're at on your VBAC journey. Also, a huge thank you to all of our new Patreons and people who keep supporting the podcast. Thanks for that. It really keeps us going.
So today we are with Amelia, who is here with her little baby, Evelyn, who's just a couple of months old. Thank you, Amelia, for joining our show today to talk to our listeners about your VBAC journey. Would you like to maybe start by telling us just a little bit about yourself?
Thank you so much for having us. My name is Amelia, or Millie. I am 21. I have two babies. One is 18 months old and one is 2 months old. We live in the western suburbs of Melbourne, Victoria. I'm a barista. I also work in a community house doing my diploma of community services, and I just bought a house with my partner, so we're very much in our happy little bubble.
Wow, that's amazing. Lovely. At 21 to have all of that going on.
Thank you.
Yes. So before you fell pregnant the first time, what were your preconceived ideas about birth?
I always knew that birth and labor, giving birth, has so much potential for transformation. And I knew that it would take a lot, like it would take my whole being and full presence. I had spoken to my mum about her births. She has four children. I had heard stories about how her labours had been long, and I was expecting a long process. I always sort of knew I wanted to have babies and I wanted to experience a natural birth.
How old were you when you had your first pregnancy?
That was in 2020. So yeah, literally I went into hospital and was induced on my 20th birthday.
Wow.
Wow. And did you have a lot of support around you, like a lot of people supporting you through the pregnancy at the time? How was that?
At the time, I was living with my partner in his grandparents' home. I didn't really have much of my own family support. A lot of my family lives in New South Wales, but my pregnancy was positive. Honestly, my partner and I, we had only been together for a few months, but we've been best friends for years and years and years. I don't know what made me think to take a pregnancy test, but I did one.
Because it just felt different to how you were normally feeling.
We had been to a music festival that week and I was just feeling really ill and not myself. I had been taking the mini pill, but not regularly enough, I don't think. And I had missed some. So I took a pregnancy test and I just remember being like speechless.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because we were both like so young, not even really serious yet. I told him and he was luckily basically like, whatever you want, I will support you. And I was like, yes.
That's great. Yeah.
And from the moment I found out, like from the moment I saw that pregnancy test, it just felt right. And I just loved that.
So I guess when you found out you were pregnant and you guys are on board now together, what influenced your decision to go public?
I went to a GP to try and figure out our like estimated due date because I couldn't remember the last date of my period or anything. I didn't track my cycle. I didn't know when we had conceived. I think by the time I went and got my dating scan done, they said it was too late for it to be accurate. And so I knew from the start my due date might not be accurate. The public system was really our only option financially.
Yes.
That was the biggest factor in deciding to go public. It just wasn't really an option for us to consider going private. But we do have two major hospitals here that we could have chosen from, or two or three. My biggest thing was sort of deciding between which hospital.
When you sort of joined that system, did you feel that you were supported being a younger mother and being a younger pregnant woman?
Because with my first baby, I chose to go to the smaller of the hospitals.
Yeah.
I felt like it had a more community-minded feel. I did have different midwives every time, but because it was small, they all tended to be the same ones on rotation. So that was good. That was like a bit of familiarity.
Where were you getting your information from during that first pregnancy?
I know like the obstetricians and the midwives in our appointments would send me home with pieces of paper with information, but I didn't feel like in our appointments I got enough education.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about my actual birth, like you see, I really didn't have enough education at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know leading up to that what I needed to know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, we know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Did you do a birth preparation course at all through the hospital?
I have to say, this was 2020. Four COVID lockdown.
Right.
Yes, so okay.
Like literally there was nothing.
It was non-existent.
There was one thing that the hospital provided, which was an online Zoom. They called it like a class, but it was just a PowerPoint presentation, and they went through what to expect. And this was when I was like 8 months pregnant too.
So not a lot of time. Yeah.
I remember watching the Zoom with my partner and not really feeling like it actually was doing anything. They told us that they weren't allowing gas for pain relief because of COVID, and I knew, okay, that's not an option for me. And I think the next best thing would have been morphine, and I, you know, that's further away from what I want.
Because you knew at that time that you wanted to pursue sort of a natural physiological birth.
Yeah. I'm a very, very like, people call me a hippie. You know what I mean? I'm a very natural person. I want a natural birth.
So let's get down to the final stages of your pregnancy.
So my pregnancy itself was very, very blessed, very healthy. I felt amazing. Because we were in lockdown, I wasn't working at the coffee shop anymore. I was able to rest at home and nest and take care of myself and my belly bump. So I felt very positive and very safe. I went post dates. I was scheduled in for a routine checkup appointment because I was over my due date. I was about 41 weeks and 5 days, and they wanted an appointment to check how everything was going. And so it was scheduled in for literally my birthday. Mm-hmm. And it was just a normal appointment. And then that appointment, they took my blood pressure and they were monitoring my baby. And the obstetrician said that the heart rate seemed to be of concern and that my blood pressure was slightly higher than it had been in my pregnancy because I'd never had high blood pressure. She actually said, "Can you come back tonight to be induced around 7 o'clock?" And I just sort of looked at her like, "Wait, what? Like tonight?" And my first response was like, "No." Like my intuition said, "No. It's my birthday. I want to go home and have my birthday dinner." But when an obstetrician is telling you this and you're a first-time mum and, you know, like there's a chance your baby's heart rate isn't right, I'm like, obviously, okay, yeah, I'll come back.
Mm.
Prior to that, there had been no indication of any concern.
Because you had gone to 41 and 5 days, was there a discussion of induction in the lead up to that, or was this the first time you'd heard about induction?
When I was about 36 weeks, the appointment around then, they mentioned, like gave me one of those pieces of paper with induction and studies and statistics and all that sort of thing. They offered me a stretch and sweep, which I declined. And yeah, they had talked about induction if I go post-dates. But at the time, I just didn't know anyone else who had gone over.
And your own mother, when talking about her birth experiences, had she gone over?
No. At the time when the obstetrician first said, "Can you come back tonight so we can induce you?" I actually did stop and I asked her, "Do you think it's an option to be able to wait? Can I come back tomorrow?" And she said, "No, I don't think that that would be a good idea." And so I went home. I had a little dinner because it was my birthday. Yeah. And we packed. I already had my bags all packed. I had put heaps of time and energy into making a hospital bag checklist, making sure I had it all ready in the car. So I had all my things and I went back to the hospital with my partner. Basically, as soon as I got there, it was maybe 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and we were the only ones in the ward. So that was cool. I had every midwife there for me. They had the wireless monitor on my belly and they inserted the balloon catheter. And then they said they would like inflate it and leave it in overnight. They said contractions might be really strong and I might have trouble sleeping, but to try and rest through it. So that's what I did. My partner just went to sleep on the floor and I was up and out of the bed and in the bed and out of the bed, going to the toilet, checking for like any like fluid or anything and having contractions, going in and out of the shower too with my wireless monitoring. So I remember having discharge in my underwear and showing them and they're like, "Yeah, this is a good sign." And I think in the morning they checked me and it was a male obstetrician doing my internal check and he said I was like not very dilated still at all. So they gave me the drip of
the induction drip. Syntocin.
Yeah, that Syntocin. So that like really ramped things up. I didn't feel very good. I was really tired. I didn't get much sleep at all. But I just kept sort of walking around. I knew to be upright and, you know, do all these things. So I was trying to do that and trying to relax as well. My partner and I watched Netflix and we were watching Animal Kingdom. So not very labor-like. Eating the hospital food. And as the day went on and the contractions got stronger, I felt like I couldn't manage it. I was mentally doubting myself. So I asked for pain relief. And being in stage four lockdown, I like the only option was morphine.
Yeah.
So I actually opted for that. And that, like, I don't know why I did that. I wish I didn't do that. It made me feel even more not like myself, but I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how long it would be and I felt out of control and this was something I could control and, you know, and anyway, it got to like 6 or 7 o'clock the next day. So it had been like 24 hours since they had started inducing me. And the same obstetrician came in and he checked me and he said, oh, you've only progressed to 2 centimeters. We usually, you know, like to see more progression than this in this time. Not only that, oh, I forgot to mention, I was strep B positive. So they had me.
You had to have antibiotics?
Yeah, okay. I had the antibiotic drip in my hand and I didn't like that either. It felt really uncomfortable and I had to like walk around and pull this thing with me everywhere. So 24 hours since I had started the induction. And yeah, he said, okay, we'll like give you a few hours, we'll up the drip, we'll come back and check. And then it was like a couple of hours had passed and it was 9 o'clock and he came in and checked me again and he said, no, you're still 2 centimeters, you've failed to progress. I will never forget those words.
Yeah.
And they had the monitor on, so they were watching the heart rate and they said that baby's heart rate was dropping with contractions. And because I had failed to progress and it had been so long, they said that they think that they need to start prepping me for an emergency C-section because of the drop in baby's heart rate. And at this point, there was like 5 or 6 people standing at the edge of the bed looking at me after this man has just checked me internally. And I just felt so powerless. Oh my God, I could cry. I felt so powerless and I just didn't know what to do. I felt like I had no option. Like,
how did you feel about their treatment of you, like, up to that point? Had you been fairly happy with the care you'd received during your pregnancy? That all sounded okay. How did you feel, though, like, during the induction, I suppose, and at the start of your labour?
Well, I had some really nice midwives. I remember them being really friendly. They let me have my diffuser on with my essential oils. They had a salt lamp. They, you know, were helping me bounce on the ball and stuff at the start of the day. But then they had changeover. And the next midwives, they weren't bad or anything, but, like,
just, you know, not as caring or understanding, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember the midwives saying, now this is going to be a little bit funny, but because we are in stage 4 lockdown, we need you to wear a mask and we need to put the blanket over your head and cover you while we wheel you down to theatre. And I was like, what? So they literally put the sheet over my head. Like, I looked like a dead body.
Oh, why would they? That's bizarre to me.
So I,
okay.
Like,
were you scared or were you just feeling like, what are they doing?
Yeah. I was scared and I was disappointed because it wasn't what I wanted. Yes. The whole thing.
Yeah.
It was never how I ever would have dreamed of it happening, you know?
Yeah.
When they passed him over to me and sort of put him on my chest, my skin wasn't really even touching him because I had a robe on and I had a mask on my face. I couldn't even kiss him. Like, they just brought him to me and I just looked at him and then sort of passed him to my partner and they took him to weigh him and my partner cut the cord and that was nice to be able to see. And then after they had done the surgery, the shaking started and it was uncontrollable. And I was like, is this normal? Am I okay? And they're like, this is normal. It's okay. And I remember the anaesthetist just squeezing my hand and saying, I'm right here. So I had on my left the anaesthetist holding my hand. And then on my right, I had my partner Jacob holding my hand. And the anaesthetist's name was Sean. And after my son was born, they asked, oh, do you know a name for him yet? Have you thought about it? And I said, actually, we're going to name him Sean. Oh. And it was, you know, it was divine timing that my anaesthetist's name was Sean, because I knew that, like, from the beginning of my pregnancy, that his name, my baby's name, would be Sean, because that was my dad's name and he passed away when I was about 4. So I'd always knew that. And yeah, it was just so meaningful. So the anaesthetist was like, oh, really? Like, yeah, it was really nice. And then once they had weighed Bub, they said, like, is it okay if baby goes down to your room with dad and has skin to skin while we stitch you back up. And I said, yeah, that's fine. I regret that now. I really wish I knew more prior to this about how important skin to skin is and, you know, that first breastfeed and everything. But anyway, they took him down and that was fine. And then I just felt so weird. And it took like an hour or something, or half an hour at least, for them to stitch me back up. I remember, because it was a man and a woman doing the C-section, the man said, oh, I've actually done a really good job on this. Like, you're going to have a really nice scar. Like, they said it was really a small scar and it was clean. And so the surgery went well.
How did that make you feel, that comment in that moment? Like, did that offer you any comfort, or did you sort of think, is that a bit odd? Or what were your thoughts when that was
being said? It felt weird. Because he said, oh, this is a really, like, I've done this well. And the woman was like, yeah, like, looked at my body and was like, yeah, you've done well. And I was like, I just felt really bizarre in that moment. But I felt good that, like, it was a good thing. He wasn't saying it was a bad thing, so I felt reassured by it. But this whole time I was just like wanting to go and see my baby.
Yeah.
It just was so weird. I kept looking up at the clock and watching the time tick by as they're stitching me up, and I'm uncontrollably shaking and just reminding myself, it's okay, Millie, you're about to see them. It's okay. Like, you're nearly there. And then they put the blanket back over me and wheeled me back down to my room. But I remember them passing baby over so I could, like, they asked me, like, do you want to breastfeed? And I said, yeah. And I remember them passing him over and having that few minutes of trying to figure out how to latch. And then he latched perfectly, though, straight away. We were so blessed that that wasn't a challenge for us.
How long were you separated from him for, would you say?
45 minutes. I was watching the clock. I knew.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was beautiful and healthy, 3.2 kilos. Because I had a C-section, I had to stay in hospital for 5 days with him. And luckily, because I chose the smaller hospital, I had my own room.
Once the epidural wore off and you got feeling back, yeah, were you in pain from the scar, or how did it feel?
A little bit, little bit of pain. And I remember really, really slowly, with a lot of help, standing up for the first time the next morning. But I remember that first shower that day, once I was standing and up, baby was asleep in the little cot in the room. So I had the door open so I could see baby from where I was showering. And it was such an emotional shower. It was like I just cried and cried and cried, looking at my baby, thinking, oh my God, like, he's here. Looking at my belly that was deflated and soft, and feeling it, and just going over my whole body and just being like sort of grounding myself after that whole experience. Yeah, just sort of letting the water wash it all away, you know? Just, it was so intense. And it was probably the start of a little bit of baby blues that we often experience. Yeah. But I was still alone. I didn't even mention, and this was actually the worst. They sent my partner home at 2 a.m. after the baby was born. They didn't let him stay in the hospital with me. They made him drive home. I remember him messaging me like, I just nearly hit a roof on the road, because they made him drive home in the dark because of COVID. Yeah. The rule was he could only stay for 2 hours, could come and visit for 2 hours the next day. I'm in this shower alone, just realizing, like, I'm completely alone right now. So that was really difficult, just having 2 hours of him a day. No one was allowed to send me food or flowers. No one was allowed to come and see me. I couldn't see my mom or any women who would understand. But another really weird thing was the whole 5 days I was there, we didn't go outside. And after I went home, I thought, this is really weird. Surely a nurse would come and say, like, do you want to go outside? Do you want to go in the sun? it felt weird that my baby was 5 days old and had never seen sunlight. You know, I think back to when my ancestors would have been birthing, they would have been out in the sun at some point. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It just felt really unnatural. But I know, like, sunshine is nature's medicine. Sunshine helps regulate your body and so many different processes for your health and wellness. Yeah.
You speak there about your ancestry. I noticed on your Instagram you mentioned your Jabur woman.
Yeah.
With your ancestry, did that have a role in the way that you imagined your birth to go?
Well, at the hospital I gave birth in, they had no cultural training whatsoever. After I had my son, I did some more research into the other hospital that I didn't go to, and I found out they have an entire ward devoted to Aboriginal women, and they have the caseload midwife program. I've read a lot of studies that show having caseload midwives, seeing the same midwives for your appointments through pregnancy, leads to less premature births in Aboriginal women. So after I had my baby, I knew straight away, if I ever get pregnant again, I want to go and I want to experience that program at that hospital where they've got the cultural training. When a baby is born, it's traditional to gift a possum skin to them. So my mum got a possum skin organized, and my brother, with a wood burner, burnt our story onto the possum skin. So it's on one side, it had Jacob, my partner, his family depicted in symbols. So that's his dad, his mum, himself, his sister, and his twin brothers. And then on the other side was basically the same, because our families are actually mirrored, because then there's my mum, her partner, my brother, me, and my twin brothers. In our siblings, we both have one girl and three boys with twins.
Oh, wow. What a coincidence.
And then it had track going down and looks like the paths cross over, and then they lead down to the bottom where it's Jacob, myself, and our baby, and how our paths have crossed and we've come together. They gifted us that, and that was beautiful. And my mum also gifted me, well, gifted Sean, a wedge-tail eagle feather. Wedge-tail eagle bunjil is known as our creator spirit. That was very special, and that feather hangs in his room still.
When you were growing up, how much of an influence did your Indigenous ancestry have?
So we have Jabwurrung heritage. However, we have not been back on country, and we aren't connected with people on country. We only found out when I was maybe 12, like, where our family had really come from. It didn't come until after my great-grandfather passed away, when we found out this whole new world of knowledge. But before that, we knew that we were Indigenous and had been told and educated about it, but didn't know who my mob was until quite late. I, all through high school, was in cultural groups and programs, and we would go on excursions and meet other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students around Victoria. We had some lovely, they're called KESOs. I don't know what that acronym actually stands for, to be honest, but they support students in schools, Aboriginal people who support Aboriginal students, like community workers. Yeah. They had the links and connections with elders so that we could actually be around elders and learn from our elders that are local. I was the Indigenous ambassador at my school, so I would always do the acknowledgement of country at our assemblies. And my brother always has done cultural dances. Yeah, so I love it.
Before we get to your second birth story and your VBAC, when you left the hospital, what were the discussions there? What did they tell you about future pregnancies?
The midwives were very good at debriefing in the days I was at hospital. I actually remember being up at like 3 a.m. on day three or something, and I had my notebook and I had a list of about 8 or 9 things that were just big worries in my mind. One of the midwives came in to do my medication and stuff, and I just asked, like, can I just please talk to you about all of my worries? And I went down my list, and she helped me feel better about every single thing on that list. Lumpy bum, that was on there. I didn't understand. I had no idea what a hemorrhoid was. And she's like, that's okay, you know, like, told me all about hemorrhoids and what to do. And
I,
like,
think
it's
most
totally
women
normal.
Don't. No one really speaks about it until after birth. Nobody warned us about this.
No. They recommended waiting like at least a year and a half before getting pregnant again. So they recommended thinking about birth control and that sort of thing. And same at the 6-week checkup for baby and I. All my GP really did was offer birth control and have a look at my scar, which my scar didn't really heal the best. Like I had this one spot that it just didn't seem to close up like until later, but that resolved itself. And I didn't want birth control because like I just want my body to be the way it is naturally. I don't want birth control to mess with my hormones and my emotions. Getting pregnant again wasn't on my radar.
Yeah.
How did it change your life having a baby then once you got back home?
My life before was very quiet because I wasn't working. I was just resting at home. I had so much time to nap and read books and play music. And then once baby came, it was a year before I picked up my guitar again after playing guitar every single day through my pregnancy. And it was hard too because we didn't live in our own house. We lived with my partner's grandparents. So there's obviously generational differences in what you do with a newborn.
Yes.
I just did not trust being around other people. I wanted to be alone with my baby. I didn't want to leave my baby with his grandparents. And every time I did, so that I could go and just rest for a moment or go to down the street or whatever with my partner, I would be so anxious the whole time. In my mind, I was having the worst thoughts of what could possibly be going on. I didn't have much of my own family support. We couldn't even go and mingle at other people's houses. But I do really wish that I had more support from my family. That affects me still, but I'm working through it.
Yeah, everyone was sort of in that boat, I guess, in lockdown and, you know, not being able to see family.
Did you ever feel like maybe at some point that in that postpartum period, like, okay, I think I've got this and I'm, you know, when did you sort of, did you feel like I'm getting confidence now and I can block anything out that's maybe, you know, not helping you mentally?
Well, at my 6-week GP appointment, I remember asking for a mental health care plan so I could get linked in with a psychologist. That was a big step in me feeling like, yep, okay, I've got this. Like I used to see a psychologist when I was pregnant and my psych actually left the practice. So I hadn't been able to continue that. As soon as I had baby and I had all these thoughts, I was like, no, I need to get linked back in. I need to be speaking to someone. Like losing my dad as a young kid and we were quite poor. I've been through a lot of things in life. So I had been seeing a psychologist since I was about 17. Another thing that helped was at 6 weeks, they actually linked me in with a mum's group and it was the best thing ever. I was the first person out of all of my friends from school who had a baby. So this group was so good just to be there and know like, yeah, I'm doing actually a really good job. This is normal. My baby is doing all the things that my baby should be doing.
Oh, that's good. So, and also the stage 4 lockdown would have probably ended by this point that you're able to have those meetups.
Yeah. And I remember I was the youngest mum in that group by far.
Yeah.
And I was the only one who had had a C-section.
Oh, really?
Everyone else, really? They were talking about how was your birth? It was all about natural birth. There was no one there, like, except the actual facilitator. There was no one there who had experienced a C-section like me. So then I felt
a little bit on the outer because of that.
Yeah.
At what point did you sort of think about your birth and reflect on it and think what we'd like to maybe do for next time?
After my C-section, it inspired me down a road of research into C-sections, into labor and birth in general. I actually found out chances of you having a C-section dramatically increase if you are induced. And I was like, oh my God, I was induced. And I didn't really feel like I needed to be induced. And I've also read a lot of things about how in the public system, a lot of the time doctors can put you on a clock, sometimes schedule an emergency C-section, which maybe wasn't an emergency, just because it works on their timeline and their schedule. And I thought about how I was the only woman in that hospital birthing unit at all. There was no one else birthing. So it was perfect for them to be able to be like, yeah, let's get the surgery over and done with. So those things all came into my mind. And so I thought, I don't want to be induced again. I really, really, really want to experience spontaneous labor. I want to know what it's like for my body to be ready and to go into labor on its own. Like, that was the biggest thing for me. I just did not want to be induced again. Like, I can't say for sure, but I just felt like if I hadn't been induced, I wouldn't have had a C-section. There are situations where an induction is necessary and does save lives, and I so respect and appreciate that. But yeah, just personally, I just wish that it was different. You know.
Yeah, you've had time to look back on your own birth and reflect on your own feelings. Tell us about, I guess, then when you felt pregnant again. Was it a surprise? Were you planning this time? What was that like?
No, we were not planning again. But I remember before we found out we were pregnant, I was still breastfeeding my son. I exclusively breastfed him till 6 months and then started supplementing with some formula. And when I felt pregnant, I was still breastfeeding most of the time though, and it was about 7 or 8 months. That's how old my son was. My partner and I were really struggling. We were so exhausted, so tired. I kept feeling like I was fighting my son to get him to sleep. I would just have so many breakdowns and I was so stressed. And I was like, surely this is not how it's supposed to be. I remember having a conversation with my partner a few days before I found out I was pregnant, saying, okay, we need to make sure there's a lot of time between having Sean and having our next baby. We're not ready. And then it was that week I found out I was pregnant. And I was like, oh my God, we just had this conversation saying we wanted to wait ages.
So then found out you're pregnant and this is happy news?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
a bit of a shock, but ultimately.
If I'm honest, we were not happy. We weren't upset, but we were really scared. How are we going to manage this? If I'm already struggling this much with one, how are we going to do two? But it was never an option to me personally to not go through with the pregnancy. I just knew, like, I can't, I have to, like, you know.
Yeah,
but
you didn't feel that you wanted to go down that path. Yeah.
Yeah. You know how I said when I found out I was pregnant with my first baby, it felt right.
Yeah.
From that very first moment, I didn't have that feeling. And then I felt guilty that I didn't have that feeling. Yeah.
I guess this time around, you know that you'd like a VBAC at this point, or did you not know, like, when you felt pregnant?
Honestly, when I first fell pregnant, I didn't even know. I had never in my life heard of the term VBAC ever. I had no idea. All I had ever heard is once you have a Caesar, always a Caesar, because my partner's mum, she had Caesars for every birth. They told her that her hips weren't wide enough for her to be able to have natural birth. So she had Caesars from the very get-go. And she has been the most supportive person with our babies. So obviously, like, she had quite an influence and, like, was able to share her stories with me. I had those preconceived ideas that, like, okay, I've had a C-section, now I'm just going to have another one. And then I found this account on Instagram, actually. It's this woman who lives in New Zealand, and her account is all about the womb, the power of the womb, the menstrual cycle, pregnancy, birth, motherhood, just all of that. And I knew she had all this wealth of knowledge about, like, natural physiological birth. And I knew that a natural birth was something I really wanted. And I messaged her and I just asked, like, hey, I've just found out I'm pregnant again. I had a C-section. Do you have any advice, I guess? And she's like, you can totally have a VBAC. I'll add you to this Facebook group.
The VBAC Australia support group.
Yeah, she sent me that link to that group. That was the first time I had ever been introduced to VBAC. Like, this woman is the reason I had my VBAC. Like, if I hadn't reached out to her and she hadn't supported me, I don't know where I would be. Then I started researching. I found your podcast and a couple of others about VBACs. And I just started listening to podcasts all the time and listening to different stories, because I didn't know anyone who had had a VBAC. I did lots of research and heard about uterine rupture. And obviously that's, I think people really make a big deal out of that. I remember that I read and I heard that usually for a VBAC, you're supposed to have at least a year between having the C-section and getting pregnant. And this was my biggest concern. I started reaching out to every mum I knew, being like, hey, what's the age gap between your babies? Like, what's the age gap? What's the age gap? What's the age gap? I just wanted to know, is it possible? Has it been done? Like, can it be done, you know? And yeah, I spoke to lots of people who've had babies really close together, even VBACs close together. So that was really helpful, knowing that even with only like a 6 or 7 month gap, you can still do it. Because once I did then go to the hospital, they said straight away, like, they asked how long it had been. They heard and they all looked really like doubtful.
So yeah, the short birth interval would have been a sort of a red flag from a hospital policy standpoint. But did you make your intentions known that you'd like to go ahead with a VBAC at those appointments?
I did, yeah. On like the groups and stuff, there were lots of ideas of questions to ask your medical providers. So I went through those and I chose some of those questions to ask, like, have you ever supported a VBAC birth before? What are the rates of C-section and induction here? All of that sort of thing. But when I started going to the new hospital, like, all of my appointments were online. Couldn't really go into the hospital. So that felt like a
lockdown 2.0. I mean, you in Melbourne, you had a few actually, didn't you?
We've been in and out of lockdowns like heaps. I think we were still in lockdowns, yeah.
Okay.
Because everything was on telehealth. I remember when I told my partner that I wanted to have a VBAC, he was really unsure about it. He said things like, with a C-section, we can choose when it happens and prepare for it. Because one of the problems we had when we had Sean was my partner only got 2 weeks off work. Like, we had to take those 2 weeks from baby's due date. And because baby came so late, by the time baby was here, my partner only got like a week or so with us before he had to go back to work. And that was just a big thing for us. So when I was pregnant again, we were talking about that. And he was saying how if we have a C-section, he'll get all of the time with baby and that won't be an issue this time. But I just kept like, no, like, I'm having a VBAC and sort of telling him about it and slowly feeding him stories about positive VBACs and stuff.
And did you sort of explain the benefits to you and baby? Did that help get him on board? And what were the sort of things you were saying just for our listeners who might be in a similar scenario?
After having my baby, I did a lot of research into physiological birth and natural birth. And I found out all about oxytocin and how amazing it is and all of the really positive effects on your mental and physical health that you get from having a completely natural birth and how you just don't get that with a C-section, like, not to that extent at all. And so I would just sort of tell him about that. And I actually fully said, it's my body, it's my choice. I genuinely like said that. And I felt really sad that he didn't fully support me 100% straight away. So like, if you're going through that, it's okay. Like, to feel sad, because I felt sad too. I can't blame him.
Yeah, I mean, his own mum had C-sections as well, and his influences are different, and he does want to make sure that he's present in that postpartum period, like you said.
And not only that, he was scared of uterine rupture and all of these risks that he had heard about. I knew, I trust myself and I know myself and I know and trust my body. He is on the outside of that. And like, doesn't have that knowing inside himself. So hearing all these risks and stuff, he was just really worried. And he's like, that a C-section would be safer. And I had to explain, actually, no, I think that a VBAC is safer for me.
In your second pregnancy, how are you feeling physically? Did you have any complications or anything like that?
There were no physical complications with my second pregnancy. However, the whole first trimester was just terrible for my mental health. I really just didn't feel okay mentally and emotionally.
What do you think was contributing to that?
I would have to say a mix of hormones from stopping breastfeeding and pregnancy hormones and sleep deprivation and just feeling alone, like isolated. Oh my God. Thanks, Evie.
So poo.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
We're very used to this, don't worry.
Yeah. Yeah, so you were saying you feel isolated. I guess lockdown might have been happening as well with at this point in time, and just feeling a bit alone in that first trimester.
But then, you know, as I moved through into my second and third trimester, I felt a lot better mentally. We had wrapped our heads around the whole idea of being pregnant again. Physically, was all good.
When did you hire your doula?
I follow this woman on Instagram, Beyond Birth Collective. I found her because I've, you know, a few online mum friends that I found who have had their placenta encapsulated. And I have read a lot about placenta encapsulation and the benefits and how it can help with baby blues and postpartum.
And energy levels postpartum. That's what I've heard, particularly iron and things like that. Yeah.
I was going to say iron, and I was really iron deficient and really struggling with my energy levels and my mental health. And I thought, like, this is something that will really help me. So I found a local woman, Beyond Birth Collective, who does placenta encapsulation. That's her main job, placenta encapsulation. And I immediately booked in for that. She has like a lot of resources on her Instagram about birth. So I stalked her and learned a lot through her. And then when I was 25 weeks pregnant, maybe, she told me and started sharing about how she was now becoming a student doula and was doing a course to become a doula. If it's something I want, she's available. And as a student doula, her rates are like half the price of an actual doula. She had heaps of resources about VBACs in her doula course. And I was like, yes, this is what I need. So it was going to be quite expensive. Like a lot, like hundreds of dollars to pay for everything. But I'm like not financially well off. I wasn't in that time. So I knew I would have to save and put away and work hard to be able to pay for this. But I knew that it was worth it to get my goal of having a VBAC. Like, I knew that it was worth it. And especially because, like, this is not to say anything bad about my partner at all whatsoever, but he, like, just wasn't very supportive. He wasn't not supportive. And so I felt like having a doula would really be helpful in educating my partner, helping him feel more confident about us having a VBAC, and just knowing that in my birth I would be supported. Like 100%, I knew I was going to have a support person there who would advocate for me and help me make this happen.
Good. That's really good that Faith sort of aligned, and this, and Courtney, is that her name?
Yeah, Courtney.
And then did your partner sort of become more supportive of your VBAC and, dare I say, potentially excited for the VBAC?
Yeah, he definitely, I actually took him with me to meet up with my doula, and yeah, like, she was able to answer any of his questions, and she offered so much to him, really empowered us to then feel confident about having a VBAC.
That's awesome. Did the staff at the hospital, the midwives, were they also aware that you're bringing a doula for the birth and now we're definitely going ahead with VBAC? How were those appointments?
Every single appointment I had to be really strong in that I wanted a VBAC. I had to, like, because I had different people every appointment. Because of COVID, they said, they actually cancelled the caseload program when I was about 20 weeks because of the lack of staffing in the hospital. We're not running that program anymore. That whole reason you came to this hospital, no, we're not doing that anymore. So that was really disheartening. So, yeah, all of that great stuff we were talking about, I didn't actually get to experience. Not having that caseload program and having different midwives and obstetricians every time, I had to keep saying, like, I'm having a VBAC, and then they'd always bring up uterine rupture and give me the information sheets about VBACs and uterine rupture and all the risks. I remember one appointment, I had a replacement obstetrician. It was meant to be with, like, my obstetrician who was, like, assigned to me, but he wasn't there, so it was this other woman that I had never met. And I went in there with this big list of, like, 20 questions that were, like, recommended to ask from my doula and from the VBAC sites. And I tried asking the questions and, like, she wasn't even really answering them. And she kept, like, changing the subject. and being really like general and broad. And like, I was like, no, I really hope you're not here when I have my baby.
I'm curious, Amelia, was one of the questions at the top of your list maybe about what happens when I get to X date, you know, knowing that you went, I guess, into later term gestation, was that on your mind?
It was, yeah. I was asking questions, like the general questions, like, have you been at a VBAC birth before? How do you feel about going past the due date? Can I decline induction? It's like, obviously, yes. Now I feel like, yeah, Millie, duh, you can decline induction. But I genuinely had to ask. Mm. Like, I genuinely didn't know that I could choose to not have that, you know?
And did they have an induction policy, or was your hospital like, no, we will not induce for VBAC, you have to have a cesarean by X date? Or
so with VBAC, they do have the policy that they usually don't like to use Syntocin for induction. They would offer stretch and sweeps instead, but they did still keep offering me induction every single appointment from like 35 weeks onwards. They would suggest induction and say, you know, if baby doesn't come before the due date, then we will be talking about induction. And I'd always be like, yeah, we'll talk about it and I'll tell you no. They would continually ask if I was certain that I didn't want another C-section.
And you were feeling okay about the risk of uterine rupture? You were feeling quite okay in yourself? What were your feelings about it?
At first I was quite concerned and scared. I did not want to experience that. It's a very scary thought. But having a doula is what really helped. She sat me down and showed me heaps of statistics and the percentage of uterine rupture that actually happens and explained it to me so I'd understand. So, yeah, I felt really confident having my doula there to support me.
Yeah. And did you have an idea of maybe did you want, because I guess the hospitals would have been recommending continuous fetal monitoring, things like that, having a cannula. Did you have an idea in your head of what you might like on the day and what you might not want to accept?
Well, usually what would happen is they'd bring up all those things in our appointment and I'd be really uncertain and say, can I think about it and come back to you? And then what I would do is ring my doula and tell them exactly what they said and like, what do you think, Courtney? What does this mean? They said, because you are post-dates and because it is a high-risk VBAC and blah, 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 we recommend continuous fetal monitoring. And I remember having that when I had Sean. And one of the big things for me was that I needed to be able to be in the shower. And I said, can I be in the shower with that? And they said, yes. Mm. But what I actually said was, how about I give permission to be monitored when I first arrive? When I arrive in labor, I will allow monitoring. However, I would like it to be intermittent instead of constant. So the obstetrician was writing that down on my notes. However, when I actually did go in, it wasn't really like that. But anyway, she also asked about doing cervical checks or a stretch and sweep. And with that, I also said no to the cervical check on admittance, that I'd be happy to be monitored, but I didn't want to be checked straight away because I didn't want that to stress me out and take me out of my happy zone.
Based on your last birth, you said that you tested positive for group B strep. So what was your plan this time around? Were you going to accept the test? And if so, yeah, talk us through that. Was that playing on your mind?
That's another big thing I was thinking about. I had conversations with my doula about it, which really helped reassure me. She said that doing the test for group B strep was optional. I didn't have to do the test if I didn't want to. The obstetricians gave me the referral to like go and get the test done. And I said, yeah, I'll get it done. And then the next appointment came around and they were like, so did you go get your group B strep test done? And I said, no, I'm not going to. They would ask why and say they really recommended it because I was positive the last time. And I said, well, basically, like, I didn't want to have that cannula in my hand. Didn't want to have to carry that thing around. I didn't want to have antibiotics, because what happened last time was when I had the antibiotics after I had baby, I ended up with the worst case of thrush of my life. It was terrible. Who wants to deal with postpartum and thrush? No one. And like when I have antibiotics, that tends to happen with my body. I didn't want to go through that again.
So yeah, you've done your own sort of reading up on group B strep and you felt comfortable with what to look out for, I guess, if baby is showing signs of infection and that sort of thing. So that research, I guess, helped you make this decision to decline the test, even though the first time around you were positive.
Yeah, because I know that if you are positive at one stage, it can change. You can go from positive to negative or negative to positive.
Yeah.
The day I had my baby, I was 42 weeks and 6 days. I literally was basically 43 weeks pregnant.
Wow. So it's, and they, how did the hospital feel about you going post-date?
Pretty much every appointment from post-dates onwards, they would say the longer we leave it, the more chance you have of an induction not working and ending in C-section. The longer we leave it, like, the higher the risks are with VBACs.
Okay, and what was your response to that?
I just had to, like, remind myself to stay strong with what I wanted. And it was really a challenge to respond to them in that situation. I didn't know what to say. I just wanted to say no.
Yeah. And you felt obviously healthy and safe in your body. You didn't feel that there was anything wrong with or anything like that. Okay.
Yeah. And my biggest thing was not wanting to be induced, because I didn't want to get induced and then have a seizure again. Being post-dates, all you hear about is induction. And so that was just really stressful. Even I had so many people messaging me online saying, does it get to a point where you have to be induced? Does it get to a point where they say, no, like, that's it, you have to have this baby now? And I kept saying, no, no, people do this. People have babies this late. This is a thing that happens. This is okay. I'm not putting my baby in danger by not getting induced.
What were the resources you drew on to help you stay strong in that moment?
Definitely looking at statistics about due dates and how inaccurate they are, how majority of babies come after their due date. Also knowing, like, our dating scan, again, with this pregnancy wasn't accurate. I didn't know when my last period was again. I didn't know when we conceived again. So, you know, my due date could very well be wrong. Maybe I wasn't 43 weeks. So, yeah, I just wanted to, like, give my body and myself the time that I didn't give myself the first time around.
And I guess, was intuition playing a role as well? Like, were you drawing on that as you went over 42 weeks beyond that?
Definitely, definitely.
Did you get any monitoring at the hospital daily? Like, was that recommended, and did you do that? Or
one of my ultrasounds at about 26 weeks-ish, they said my baby's growth had declined, and they said my baby was only on, like, the 10th percentile for weight. With smaller babies, like, they tend to be not as good at birth, basically. Like, they said smaller babies sometimes can't manage a long labor, or, you know, they struggle in labor more being smaller. I think they even said with small babies, they don't usually allow water births. And I'm like, my baby's fine. Like, I know that my baby is fine. But they just wanted some monitoring to, like, check on fluid. So I actually had to go in weekly, like, every week for about 5 or 6 weeks at the end of my pregnancy, so they could get a good read and know that baby was all good. And that was really stressful because they were really understaffed, and I would have to wait hours and hours and hours for my appointment, even though my appointment is booked in at a certain time. Like, they were just so behind all the time. The hospital became a place that I didn't want to be at. How am I going to have my baby here? Like, I've had all these annoying experiences of having to wait around and you not having the staff around to support us. But at the end, I actually cracked it, and I was like, you know what? I'm confident within myself, and I'm just going to say, no, I don't feel like it's necessary for me to go in today for my appointment. So I think my last two monitoring appointments, I actually didn't go. I chose to stay at home, stay relaxed, not drive all the way in and know that I'd spend my whole day waiting around for them. Like, I completely had trust in my body and my baby that we were okay. If I had any feeling of, like, anything other than that, I would have gone in. But not only that, I had another growth scan to follow up, and they said, like, oh, baby's actually gone up to, like, the 15th or 20th percentile. Like, she's put on weight. And I'm like, see, told you.
Yeah, yeah. Just before we get into your birth story, did you do things like chiro and acupuncture as well during your pregnancy? Any other like physical
things I wish I did were like yoga and chiropractic stuff, but I didn't do those. I did do acupuncture, but not during my pregnancy. That was actually as a form of induction.
Did you go into spontaneous labor this time, or what happened?
Yes. Just smiling.
I love that smile as you ask that question, Steph.
Yes, I did. The obstetricians keep suggesting a stretch and sweep. I don't want it. 42 weeks, I booked in to get acupuncture done. I was also bouncing on a birthing ball for like a whole week before this. I was drinking pineapple juice every day, like liters of it.
Dates?
No, I didn't try dates.
That's another common one, yeah.
Next time. And yeah, sex and orgasms, the whole thing. I was trying everything. So I just thought, you know what? Let's give acupuncture a go too.
Raspberry leaf tea, did you try?
Oh, I did, yeah.
Yeah?
I was drinking that a lot, yeah.
So what happened after the acupuncture?
Well, the acupuncture itself was a really sort of out-of-body spiritual experience. It was really weird.
And did it work? Did you go into labor that day?
I drove home. It was either that night or the next night. I went to the toilet and there was fluid on my underwear and I had like the slightest pain, abdominal pain. And I was like really doubting, is this the start? Or like, did I just pee myself a little bit? Yeah, I saw the fluid and I was like, okay, this might actually be the start. And I didn't even tell anyone. I just kept it to myself and I was, please. Yes. Yeah. And I went back to sleep and then got up and like there was more fluid but it was a weird color. It wasn't clear. Fluid should be completely clear. It was just, it didn't look right. You know, I still felt confident and I still had trust that baby was okay. Yeah. Contractions started on the Monday night, I think. So I would get up out of bed through the night, not being able to sleep. Every few hours, I'd wake up like with painful contractions.
And your waters were still leaking at this point, right?
Yeah, I was leaking fluid, yeah.
What color would you say it was?
A bit yellowish. So I thought, okay, my waters have ruptured and it's just slow release. I called my doula because my doula like was on call from 37 weeks. She came over, she brought the cub. CUB, which is to support upright positions in birth. During the day, like my contractions actually eased, but then at nighttime would come back. Me and my doula had already discussed our birth plan, and in my birth plan was to stay laboring at home for as long as possible before going to the hospital, and only to go to hospital when the contractions like 5 minutes apart to head to the hospital. So this whole time, I'm just waiting for them to come closer together. And it just wasn't happening. And this went on for 4 days. So she would go home and come back and go home and come back. Kept rubbing clary sage on my ankles and on my belly and really breathing and moving my hips through the contractions. Sitting on the toilet really helped. Bouncing on the ball. Really rolling around my hips on the ball would help through the contractions. I told my partner to stay home from work. It happened. Baby didn't actually come for the next 3 days or so, but I told him, I need you to be here in case baby comes. This time around, I got my partner to actually ask if he could be on call and basically start his paternity leave from when baby was being born. And they supported him with that, which was awesome. And he was going to have 3 weeks of annual leave. So then we got his mum to come and look after Sean. She took Sean to her house and he stayed there for like a week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
you're just waiting for this bubba to make, her way.
I really just wanted to be able to be in the zone, focus and, not have to worry about anything else. So, I went through this for a few days and managed to sort of get minimal sleep. I'll always look back on it really fondly. It was such a nice experience. There was a little bit of anxiety because I knew the fluids looked like they could be meconium stained and that could be why they were that color. But I trusted my intuition and trusted that we'd be okay. And then, it started on the Monday night and, we got to the Thursday morning and it was like 6 a.m. I used this contraction timing app, and the contractions actually this morning started coming every 7 minutes. And I was like, okay, this hasn't happened yet. So far, my contractions have been every half hour. I've got a feeling today could be the day. About 7 o'clock in the morning, I knew like they definitely had stayed consistent, like 4 or 5 minutes apart. I was like, oh my God, it's happening. So like yeah. I woke up because he was asleep. He took so long to get up. I woke him up and I said, Jacob, like, I think it's happening. I think I want to go to the hospital this morning.
Yeah.
And he just stayed in bed. He just kept sleeping. And I'm watching the contraction timer like get closer and closer together. And I'm like, what do I do? Like, still in bed. Oh my God, what if we don't make it? Like, all those thoughts came into my head. But he got up, you know, he was chilling, having a shower, taking his time. And I'm like, come on, we have to go. So it was like 8:30 by the time we got in the car, full time. So we had traffic. The contractions kept getting closer together, which is a good thing. It's like, it's happening. My body is doing the things that I was told last time it failed to do. I sat on a pillow to help with the comfort of driving and the bumps. And I really just had to grit through that half an hour drive to the hospital. And by the time we got there, they were like 3 or 4 minutes apart. When I got there, right, this hospital, they have a rule that to go up to the maternity assessment center on level 3, you have to get a RAT test done first. No one is allowed up there unless you have a negative RAT test result. And I understand that that's very important, but I was literally having contractions 3 minutes apart and they made me get a RAT test.
Are you kidding?
Like, I'm not kidding. This is no lie. They made me sit in this tent where they make you sit for 20 minutes and wait for the result. And there was 2 other people in there sitting across from me. And I had my big, big like blanket. See that big blue blanket there? It's like a massive fluffy blanket. I had it over my head so that it stayed dark and I could stay in my zone because it was this brightly colored fluorescent tent. I know that with physiological labor, it really helps to be in a dark, safe environment. I told them I was in labor and having contractions. I had rang the maternity ward and told them we were on the way to the hospital. And I had told them on the phone about my fluid looking a little bit weird. And, you know, they said, do you want to come in? And I said, not yet. Like, I'll tell you when I'm ready. I did all those things. So yeah, I got the RAT test done and there were 2 other people sitting across from me waiting for their results. And they're sitting there watching me with this bewildered look on their faces because every 3 minutes I'm having a contraction gripping onto my chair for dear life. Then I stood up because the contraction pain was so much. I had to stand up to deal with it and I wanted to move around. And then my fluids leaked all over the floor.
Oh my gosh.
And all these poor people are looking at me and the nurses are like, oh, grab something to clean it up. And by this point, my partner, like he had been parking the car, like trying to find a car park. So he finally walks in as this is happening and he sees my fluids all over the floor. And like all these people, I just will never forget the look on their faces as they're watching me in labor leaking all over the floor. So my partner walks in and I'm like, here you see, can I just go up to maternity, please? And the nurses are like, oh, yeah, we'll just ring them and let you know that you're still waiting for your RAT result. I'm like, Jacob, go get a wheelchair from somewhere, please. Like, I can't walk. And he's like, where do I get a wheelchair from? And I'm like, security, go run inside. So he finally comes running out with this wheelchair and wheels me in into the elevator. Up to maternity assessment, told them how I'd been in labor for a few days, leaking fluids.
Yeah, when you told them about the leaking fluids, what was their reaction? Did they suggest antibiotics at this point because they didn't also know whether you were positive or negative to group B strep? What was their recommendation at that point?
Yeah, they recommended the IV antibiotics and I said no. In hindsight, I would have said yes, knowing what happened after, but I said no because I still felt very strongly like I didn't want to have these antibiotics that change my microbiome and change my baby's microbiome. I didn't want to cause any problems for her like by having the antibiotics. And I said no. And they told me it does look like your baby has passed meconium in the womb. which is very, very normal, being 42 weeks and 6 days. Being postnatal is very normal. Yeah, that was, like, reassuring. Like, this has happened before, but I do know the risks of infection. I've told my doula that we're at the hospital, and she's at the hospital just waiting to be let in. But because they've got me in this room, my doula's not allowed to come in until they've moved me to our actual birthing room. So I had to actually labor in that room, just Jacob and I, for like actually quite a while. It felt like maybe 1 or 2 hours before I was able to go into my birthing room and meet my midwife and have my doula there. So I genuinely had my blanket over my head this whole time because I just wanted to keep it dark and safe in my space. Had my birth music playlist playing, which my doula created. It was really good, but I know that probably looked weird. And eventually they came in and they checked me. They did the cervical check and they're like, oh, you're 2 centimeters. And I'm like, oh, this is the best thing ever. Because when I had Sean, they said I had failed to progress because I was only at 2 centimeters. And I'm like, I'm already at the stage that they told me that I couldn't get past. It was incredible. I was like, yes, like it's happening. I'm doing it. And that was like really reassuring as well. At this stage, I'm just in this little room. So it was really kind of annoying that I had to wait. It felt like it sort of maybe delayed my labor a little bit because it took me out of my zone a bit. But eventually then, you know, after they've checked me and all of that, and I've waited around for ages and my contractions are literally 3 minutes apart, like nearly 2 minutes apart, I get into my birthing room and meet my midwife. And an obstetrician comes in and my doula is allowed to come in. And my doula came in and she set up all of our birthing affirmation cards in front of the bed on the bedhead. There was one card that really helped me all the way through my labor and transition and when I was pushing. And it said, my cervix softens, widens, and opens for my baby. And like it had this visual of a cervix and it looked like a portal, and I just kept visualizing that and looking at it and visualizing my insides opening, relaxing, just really opening myself. It just really helped. I was finally able to hop in the shower, which was amazing. I knew it would be amazing, and it was. And I had the wireless continuous monitoring on. And when I got in this room, yeah, when the obstetrician and midwife came, I felt like they just wouldn't stop talking. No. They would not stop. Obviously, they're doing their job. They have to inform you and get informed consent. So they had to go through every single thing. Like every single thing, all the risks, and I just kept having to it felt really distracting, and like it wasn't helping my labor progress. The doctor was asking about the antibiotic and if I wanted it because like baby had passed meconium in the waters. He was asking, is there something you want? And I said no, and he asked why, and I said because I don't. And he said, why? And I said, I just don't. Just no. Like, and I was looking at my doula, like, please back me up here. Like, I just wanted them to stop talking so I could get through it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, my midwife was amazing, though. She came in and she's like, I'm so glad that I'm here for your VBAC. You know, we're really happy that I'm here today because I'm known for natural births and helping with VBAC. So it was really good. I felt positive that I had a VBAC supportive midwife there who had been like done this before. She actually said she's known as a bit of a hippie, and I was like, me too. Like, yeah, like it's really, really good that she was the midwife on staff. And she kept saying, I'm sorry, I know that like this is not really helping you right now, but we need to just give you all the information. And I'm like, I know you're doing your job, it's okay. But yeah, and I could hardly speak.
Yeah.
Like I could get 1 or 2 words out. That's all this whole time. So I'd be like, water. And then my doula would bring the water to me, or I'd be like, shower and they'd know they needed to help me to the shower, or food and they'd know like I need a snack, or yes or no, like that's all I could manage. The midwife kept coming in and out of the shower to adjust the monitor because it kept dropping out and it wasn't working and it was really annoying. And she's like, I'm really sorry, love, but it's just not working in the shower. And I'm like, but you told me that this is supposed to work in the shower. Like, and she's like, I'm really sorry. Please, I would really, you know, recommend, I can't remember what it's called, but the fetal monitoring that they put on the baby's scalp.
Oh, the scalp. Electrode. The
internal.
Yeah.
Like when she said this, she presented it as an option because that would mean I could be in the shower and still have the constant monitoring. And I said, okay, can I, like, is it an option not to? Can I just stay in the shower? And she said, she literally said, no, you need to have this constant monitoring because you are a VBAC and baby has pooed in the womb. There are high risks. Like, we need this monitoring to be constant. I had to say yes to the electrode monitor. I don't know why I didn't want it. I just wanted them to leave me alone and leave it how it was. I didn't want to have to get out of the shower so they could put it in so that I could get back into the shower. I did not want to leave the shower at all whatsoever. And I was like, can you put it in while I'm in here? And she's like, no, I'm sorry, love. Like, I can't. So they had to help me move from the shower to the bed so they could put the electrode in, then so I could go back in the shower. And then after that, it was good because they didn't have to come in and keep adjusting the straps on my belly. And I was bouncing on the ball in the shower. And then I remember my doula came in and kind of asked, do you want to come out of the shower for a bit? Maybe try something else? And at this point, they sort of thought baby was having trouble moving down, like maybe baby was stuck. And then that's where having a doula really came in handy, knowing the spinning baby's techniques. My doula helped me lay on my side on the edge of the bed, and they put the peanut ball in between the knees.
I think it's, is it called a side lying release?
Yeah.
Did they suspect baby was posterior maybe?
And but they said more like baby was maybe on the side.
Okay, like yeah.
Trying to rotate, but not yeah. That. Yeah.
Okay. And so, did you feel any extra pain? Like, did you have any inkling that baby was stuck yourself, or was it?
It was a lot of back pain.
Mm.
Like I was really feeling my contractions in my back. Yeah. Because I remember my doula asking that question, like, because I think she had the inclination that maybe baby was posterior and she was trying to gauge like my response and what was happening. Back pain.
Yes, that's a classic sign of a posterior presentation. But so did you find that the side lying release and any other spinning babies positions, did you assume, did that help with baby's positioning and your labor contractions?
Yeah, it definitely helped. Definitely helped. Mm. Laying down really felt like the opposite of productive. Almost.
It felt like it was hindering your progress.
Yeah. Should I be laying down? I feel like I should be upright, you know?
But
counterintuitive.
Counterintuitive. That's the word. Yeah. Lying down felt very counterintuitive, but with the peanut ball between my legs, knowing the spinning baby's techniques that I had read about while I was pregnant, and knowing what posterior baby meant and all of these things, having an understanding of like physically what my pelvis is like and how babies have to sort of rotate out through, I knew that it was helping. After quite a while of that, actually, it was around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, they said I was at 8 centimeters. Like, and I was at 8 centimeters. This was like the biggest thing for me because with my first baby, they told me you're at 2 centimeters, you failed to progress. And I got to 8 centimeters all by myself. No, like, well, with my doula support, obviously, but like no syntocin, no induction. Yeah, I did it myself and I just felt so proud and so relieved I could do it and I wasn't a failure. But then I started mentally struggling and I had this anxiety and this feeling that I couldn't get out of my head. The thought just kept coming to my head of prep me for a Caesar. It just kept coming and I couldn't get it out of my head. And I like told my doula, my inner voice is so loud right now, telling me to tell you to prep me for a Caesar. And she's like, why, Millie? Like, you've come this far. You're doing so well. We have talked about this so many times for so long. You know that this is what you want. You know that in transition, it can get really, really difficult. Yeah, she like gave me a pep talk, reminded me how far I had come. The whole reason I wanted her to be there was I knew how much of a mental game that it was going to be for me. And that it wouldn't be the physical struggle, it would be the mental struggle and like my self-confidence. We knew that we could expect this to happen and these thoughts to happen. So, but when they were happening, I was so worried because I knew a baby had passed meconium in the waters. There was risks. I had been in labor for like 4 days. I just thought if I just get prepped for a Caesar, it'll just be done and baby will be here and, you know, everything will be fine and it will be over. But I didn't really want that. All I really wanted was baby to be safe and me to be safe and for us to get through it, you know. I started getting this feeling that was involuntary, that almost like I needed to push, almost. And I felt really uncertain about it and I hadn't felt this before. And I was trying to describe it to the midwife, like what was going on. And it was a really different feeling that I've had for the last few surges. And when that started, I'm actually pretty sure I might have still been laying down. And then that is why I felt like I had to move and stand up. And when I did stand up, that really helped, like relieve it.
Did you have any bad back pain still at this point, or had that eased?
Yeah, a little bit, but like laying down with the peanut ball had definitely helped that. And I felt a lot more like baby was engaging, felt heavier. I remember being in the shower again, having these sort of urges to push and just trying to breathe through it. My midwife suggested instead of doing my big heavy breaths that I was doing, to go like...
Oh, the horse's
and
breath.
And blow raspberries instead when I had that feeling. Yeah, that really helped. Because basically, like, they didn't want me to start pushing too early and have more chance of a tear or anything. So they wanted me to really, really ride through that feeling for as long as I could. So I did. And then they sort of, my doula was like, maybe you should come over to the bed. I think you're really close. Not to get on the bed, but just to use the bed for support. So I like bent over and yeah, had my hands on the bed and then I actually put my knees up on the bed. So I was on my hands and knees on the bed and my hands were on the bed head rail and I was looking up at where my birth affirmation cards were and really looking at that cervix card and really visualizing my cervix opening and fully surrendering to it. My midwife was like, oh my God, I can see ahead. And I'm like, really already? Like, I was really ready to start pushing. And it didn't take long at all.
It was definitely involuntary. But then I sort of, with the encouragement from the midwife, I started pushing with it.
I sort of screamed through it.
My doula was like, oh my, what? Pulled out her phone and started recording. Yeah, my partner came over and I was holding his hand. And this whole time, he had sort of just been sitting back, watching me in my power, letting me do my thing and, you know, holding my hand if I wanted it. But my doula was the one who was physically like supporting me, rubbing my back if I wanted it and all that sort of thing. But now I think my partner realized like, okay, yeah, better step it up here. There was one push where I thought I had pushed enough. I had done the pushing, I had pushed. And my midwife was like, just keep going, just a little bit more, like just a little bit more pushing. And I kept that push going and then my baby came out with that push. I just pushed that little bit longer and she, yeah, came out and I just remember how it felt and it felt amazing. Oh, and then she was crying and they passed her, the midwife caught her and I put my hands down to feel and then I grabbed my baby from her, pulled her up through my legs and then up onto my chest and sat up. Oh, And then we just sort of like sat like that for a few minutes, and it was just like me and her, like we were the only ones in the room and the only ones in the world. And I felt so, I couldn't believe that it was over already. She's here now. I did it.
Yeah.
In disbelief. I knew in my birth plan I wanted a physiological third stage. So within about 20 minutes, at first the midwife said they usually maybe half an hour or so, an hour, and they just sort of left us. Yeah, and I was then started to breastfeed instantly as well.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, so we had our skin to skin straight away with our breastfeeding straight away. And that was so healing for me, like so different to when I had Sean. And like, yeah, she had no troubles latching or anything, which was really good as well. When you breastfeed after having baby, it can bring on those uterine contractions again. So I started having that sort of pain. And after about 20 minutes, my midwife came back and just wanted to check. She said, I think your placenta is pretty much ready. Do you want to just give a little bit of a push and see if you can just push it out? And I did, and it just pushed out. It just came out. And this is the first time I've seen a placenta, because with Sean in surgery, I didn't get to see it. In my first birth, the placenta, it was like not respected at all the way it should be, I feel. And then we kept the placenta and baby connected for a long time until, all the blood had sort of run through and the cord changed colour, and then my partner cut the cord. When I pushed baby out as well with that final big long push, all the extra fluid came out as well that had been stuck. It was yuck, the colour of it. Like, they knew she had passed meconium in the water.
Did she need any suctioning after birth? Was she breathing okay? Were apgars all good?
It was all good, yeah, it was all good. After, we checked out the placenta and all that, they had a look at my vagina and the midwife said I had torn and wasn't sure if it was a second or third degree tear. She was like, all right, I'm going to go and get a doctor and actually look and make sure. So whenever that doctor became available, she came up and had a look and put her fingers inside and had a feel, and she was like, I'm sorry, I know, but they have to check. And she said, it's okay, it hasn't torn all the way through, like it's not too bad, it's not as bad as we thought it could have been, and yeah, we can stitch this up, like you'll be okay. We were going to stay in the maternity ward for a night at least. Because baby had passed meconium in the womb, they wanted to do some extra tests. They did a blood test later that night. It was like nearly midnight or something. They asked if they could take her and do some tests. They obviously offered if I wanted to go with them, but I said, you can take her and I'll just sleep for a little bit. But when they came back, they woke me up and they said that the tests showed that there was a slightly high chance of infection. So they have certain inflammation markers in the blood test, I think, that were a little bit high. So they said they wanted to do another check in the morning and see how they'd gone. But they recommended antibiotics as a precaution, because in newborns, infection can get really serious really fast and you can't always see it with our human eye. So I said, yep, like I consented to the antibiotics. So that night they put a cannula in her hand and they had her on the antibiotic drip. And they said that, maybe it could be either 2 to 3 days or 5 days, depending on how her blood tests go. And that was really, really hard for me. Like up until this point, my birth and everything had been really positive and I felt really empowered and backed my decisions, but at this point I thought, like, I just started feeling really stressed. I just didn't like the look of the cannula in her little hand. It didn't look natural. None of her newborn clothes fit, so I had to get my partner to go and get more clothes and try and find something that would fit over the cannula. Then they kept doing tests and I got discharged from maternity the next day, but baby had to stay in the newborn nursery. So
that was a really big challenge. And it was just really hard for me to deal with because it was something I wasn't expecting. They gave me the option, though, to go home because they had nurses there 24/7 who were looking after the babies. A lot of the other parents in there would come and go home to sleep at night and come back in the day. But the idea of leaving her at 2 days old was just incredibly hard for me. So the first night I tried to stay with her, and then I think the baby blues hit that night and she was cluster feeding. And I just remember at like 3 a.m. it was like night two, I think, I was just absolutely losing it. I couldn't sleep and I was crying to the nurse, and baby wanted to be on me, but I couldn't sleep with her on me, and it was just really hard. But, you know, as we do, I got through. And then they did more tests and they said that her infection markers were still quite high, and they recommended finishing the full 5 days of antibiotics. Being born on the Thursday, we didn't end up going home until the Wednesday morning. And I was then doing trips back and forth between my house and the hospital, which is a half an hour drive. And this is when petrol went up to like $2 a litre as well. So this was really hard on us. And then we had to count in like the costs of the hospital food and parking. It was just a lot that we hadn't even considered. And I experienced a lot of anxiety being away from Evelyn. Yeah, having to go home to sleep. I just, yeah, really struggled with that. But I knew I had to do it. After the 5 days of antibiotics, Evelyn, like, she didn't even look sick. She was totally fine, putting on weight, feeding really well, not having any troubles with sleep or feeding. It was literally just her blood tests that they wanted to see improve. So I wasn't worried about her in that sense. I knew she was where she needed to be. And all the nurses in the newborn care nursery were really helpful and supportive, kept doing tests, blood tests pretty much daily, to see that the numbers were going down. I sat down and actually asked the newborn doctor questions about the infection and what it all meant, because I felt very confused. I asked if they knew what type of infection it was, and they said no. And they said because Evelyn is showing signs of improving, they didn't see it necessary to continue investigating what the infection was. It was more just to make sure she didn't get any worse. And that, to me, I didn't like the uncertainty of that, but I trusted their medical opinion. And it had been hard for me morally, because in labor I had declined the antibiotic IV strip, and then she needed antibiotics anyway, and I was thinking I should have just said yes to the antibiotics in labor. But you never know what's going to happen. And I also, you know, who's to say that if I had had that drip in labor that it wouldn't have affected my progress, because it is quite disruptive. Well, it was for me when I experienced it with my first son.
It sounds like you were very well informed when you made those decisions. So I think that's a really good place to be, you know, that you didn't feel the pressure to make a decision. You didn't feel coerced. You were making those decisions on, you know, on your call. And I think that's what makes a big difference. And being in the hospital was the right place, you know, for you, because of what happened afterwards. We all have ideas of how our birth's going to go. And if it doesn't go that way, it's really good to keep an open mind.
Yeah.
And I think, what you've gone through, it kind of shows how it's a testament to you and being flexible in those scenarios, knowing when, with the best knowledge that you had, when you need to get the help, it's there. So it wasn't group B strep.
No, I think it was because she was a prostate's baby and had pooed in the womb. That can sometimes lead to infection. And all of the nurses and my doula and the doctors, they all said, like, it's pretty common when you're 42 weeks and 6 days for baby to have passed meconium. So that was reassuring.
So when you got home, did you feel like now you can allow yourself to be elated after the whole experience?
I just remember feeling so much joy, and I was so, so, so proud of myself for actually getting my V back. I put so much time into researching and listening to people's positive stories, really affirming I am having this feedback. And I did everything that I could to have it. So once I did have it, all of those happy oxytocin chemicals and getting to be home, bonding with my baby, just sitting on the couch with her like I should be, resting with her and feeding and bonding, that I just felt so, so, so happy. Recovery was a lot easier this time than it was with my first, mentally and physically. I think this time around, being my second baby, I kind of knew how to cope in difficult moments, whereas with my first, those moments really got to me. Overall, it's been really nice.
What were the Aboriginal cultural practices that Evelyn got to experience when she came home?
When Evie was about 5 weeks old, I took her to our local Aboriginal community-controlled organisation, and they were starting off with a smoking ceremony with our local elders. And I went and got to speak to the elders. All the aunties came and held baby and held me. And, yeah, we had a smoking ceremony where we sort of cleanse ourselves and our energy physically and spiritually with smoke. And that was really, really beautiful, just to be surrounded by elders. Something we've done with both babies, with Sean and Evelyn, is the gift of the possum skin. That's beautiful. And as they get older, we can add to them and eventually have a cloak for them. So it'll be all different possum skins sewn together.
How is your VBAC? I guess, you know, you being a young mom, has your VBAC, has it affected you in ways that you didn't know it could?
You know, when I speak to mums who come up to me for coffee on the weekends because I'm a barista, a lot of the time it ends up being another mum who's had a C-section, and they're like, oh, you had a VBAC? And they just ask me a million questions. So I've been able to teach people and open people's minds. Mentally, I think it had a really, really positive impact on my mental health. I just have had so many moments of pure joy and appreciation for the world and my life and my baby.
Thank you so much, Amelia, for sharing your story with us and for sharing your cultural practices and giving us an insight into that part of your life, which is beautiful. So thank you.
Thank you so, so much for the opportunity to share my story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC journey. If you like the show, please subscribe, leave us a review, or consider joining our Patreon. We thank you very much for your support.
VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.